Hello, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of the BC Association of School Psychologists podcast. We are excited to bring you helpful ideas for your practice, supported by experts and research. We would first like to acknowledge and honor the traditional unceded territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, Coast Salish, Tsuut'ina Nation, Esquimalt, and Songhees peoples, where we live, work, play, and learn. Now, today, our podcast episode features Dr. Daniel Ansari. He is a professor and Canada Research Chair in Developmental Cognitive Neuroscience and Learning in the Department of Psychology and the Faculty of Education at the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, where he heads the Numerical Cognition Laboratory. Daniel and his team explore the developmental trajectory underlying both the typical and atypical development of numerical and mathematical skills using both behavioral and neuroimaging methods. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Good morning. Our listeners are largely school psychologists, and we're wondering if there are key pieces of information that you'd like to highlight to hook our listeners and ensure that they take away from this discussion.
Thanks very much, Kathleen, for that question. In thinking about that question, a couple of things come to mind. I think one of the really exciting things that I'd like to share is that I think we are at a point now in research where we're really starting to understand what are some of the key foundations upon which mathematical skills are built. And I think this is exciting for all of us researchers, school psychologists, teachers, because we're in a position now to have better assessments of key foundations early on. I think for years, you know, we really assess children's math skills by testing what they do in school, and we didn't really look at the underlying processing components in the same way that we do in reading. So I think that's a really exciting advancement, and I think we'll see a lot more progress over the next few years, which will hopefully, you know, have real implications for practice, both from an assessment point of view, but then also going forward from how do we then, you know, use the results from assessment to inform practice, early intervention, and hopefully prevention of, you know, lifelong difficulties with math. So that's one piece of information that I think is quite hopeful and exciting these days.
Yeah, and we are certainly excited to dive deeper into that in just a little bit. Before that, though, we'd love to learn more about your background, kind of your story into what brought you into your current expertise field.
Yeah, thanks, James. My story sort of started when I was an undergraduate in psychology, and I chose psychology because I wanted to become a psychotherapist. And then, you know, as any undergraduate, normally what you expect from your degree is not what it turns out to be. And I went to the University of Sussex, which was very much focused on cognitive science. I was in a school of computing and cognitive science, so we learned a lot about computer science as well. And I became increasingly interested in cognition. And then I took a course on development, two courses actually, one which was infant development, the other one which was social development. And that's when I discovered that I had a real passion for developmental psychology and for the study of child development more generally. I didn't really know which area of child development I wanted to go into. I didn't really actually care because I was chiefly interested in studying developmental processes. And then I took a course on brain development. So then it became clear to me that there needed to be a connection between neuroscience and psychology as well. So then it really accidentally, I was sitting in the coffee lounge of my department one afternoon. And, you know, this was back in the late 90s. So people were still printing job advertisement. And there was a newsletter from the British Psychological Society. And I was sort of leafing through that while I was eating a sandwich or something like that. And I suddenly saw this ad, Institute of Child Health, PhD position. So I read more into it, and it was a PhD with an advert for a PhD position with Annette Kamloff-Smith. And the aim of the PhD was to better understand mathematical abilities of children with Williams syndrome. I hadn't heard of Williams syndrome before, so I looked into it and became really quite interested in it, and I applied. And that's sort of how I ended up studying numbers and development. But my real passion has always been understanding developmental processes. And I happened to sort of stumble across numerical development and then also working with children who have, exceptionalities, who have uneven profiles of strength and weaknesses. So I then simply found the domain of number and the study of mathematical development to be a domain which you can use to study lots of things. The interaction between culture and biology, the learning difficulties, exceptionalities, brain processes. So it, while from the outside it looks like a narrow domain, it can actually be used to study all things in development. So my trajectory has always been sort of accidental, and I've always gone with things that I thought sounded really interesting. I didn't really have a grand plan to begin with, or at least the plan that I had is not the plan that I turned out realizing.
I always love hearing people's stories, and I find that listening to them and how one follows one's passions is really fascinating. We took a look at the numerical cognition laboratory, and that seems very fascinating, and seems to really tie in that cognition and numerical piece and learning regarding different domains. I'm wondering if you can give us some background on that, and how you hope it will be useful to school psychologists and teams and professionals in the area.
Sure, Kathleen, absolutely. So the Numerical Cognition Lab is basically my research group, we're sort of I would say an eclectic collection of different research interests that are realized by members of my group. So there are people working in the lab who are directly working with schools and doing things such as developing screeners or measuring developmental processes. But we also do just basic science work on, the brain mechanisms underlying number processing, or, trying to understand the underlying cognitive architecture that supports children's math development. So I really try to always have the basic and the applied interwoven with one another. We also, as a research group, really try to engage with our local educational community. So we, our aim is to always have strong partnerships with our Thames Valley District School Board, our London Catholic District School Board, and other boards in the area. We really adopt a model whereby we try to collaborate and try to, do research on issues that are relevant to educators. So let me give you one very concrete example, which we're excited about right now. I'm sure this is also in use in British Columbia, the idea of number talks, that children in classrooms produce multiple solutions to arithmetic problems and they discuss them. So nobody's actually researched number talks. So at the moment, we're working with our partners in London Catholic District School Board to better understand number talks and to also build an assessment of students' strategies that's related to number talks, because so many tests of arithmetic are just, here's a bunch of problems, see how many of them you get correct. What we want to capture is how students actually think about the math that they're doing, and trying to understand, are some students more creative, more sophisticated, if you like, in their strategy production, and where does that come from? Does that have to do with their ability to think creatively, with their analogical reasoning ability? So that's one example of how we intersect between schools and our lab, and try to pick research topics that have the potential of ultimately informing educational practice.
Love that. And looking at those foundations, I know that one thing I have noticed is sometimes in the lower elementary grades, kids can seem to be doing good because they are really relying on their memory, and it looks great. And then when that more problem-solving piece comes, they're sort of hitting a wall. So I love the idea of ways to flag that so we can put some intervention if there is sort of an underlying issue and they're just relying on memory and really are not understanding it at a conceptual level. Because I don't know if that is your experience or James's, but I do sometimes find that kids can appear to be doing well from the basic sort of math facts fluency side of things, but then in upper levels they do really struggle. So I find that interesting that we are trying to raise awareness on that and really take a look at that, those underlying tasks that one needs to do. Thank you.
Yeah, and if I can just add to that, Kathleen, I mean, one of the hypotheses that we want to look at is that through producing multiple strategies, through getting students to think about how they might be able to make a shortcut here or combine this strategy with that strategy, we believe that in it of itself builds fact fluency. The more ways you can, and this is not just true of math, I mean, we all know this about life in general, the more different approaches we have to the same problem, the better we are at solving those problems. And I believe the same is true in math. So I believe that fluency is really important, but I also believe that using multiple strategies is one pathway towards fluency as well.
On that note, Daniel, I am wondering if you've noticed any abilities specifically that are more associated with success in math. So you mentioned, for example, flexible or creative thinking. Kathleen's talked a little bit about memory. And there are all these other things that, you know, as school psychologists, we assess kids on because we're querying, oh, what is this kid's learning profile? So we might look at things like verbal comprehension or your knowledge crystallized intelligence. We might look at visual spatial skills. What's your take, Daniel, on any sort of connections or stronger associations with math?
Yeah, that's a really good question, James. I don't think there's a single answer to that question. So maybe it helps to compare math in this regard a little bit to reading. So I think in reading, we do know that there are a set of predictors that are pretty uniquely and strongly associated with reading, such as phonics. In math, I think it's a little bit more complicated because math is so many different things, right? We can think about number and magnitude, we can think about geometry, we can think about statistics. There's so many different aspects to learning math that I think it's difficult to pick up one predictor. I mean, we know in the early years that children's understanding of numerical quantities and the relationship between quantities and symbols is really important. Later on, we know that other cognitive factors such as working memory, speed of processing and so forth relate to math achievement. But the interesting thing, for example, with something like working memory is there's a really strong relationship between working memory and math. But that doesn't mean that if you train working memory, you get better at math. So we also need to be so careful in this space of distinguishing between things that are, you know, predictors of individual differences that can help us to understand differences between children and factors that are actually malleable in an educational context. So you can have something that's really strongly, X can be strongly related with Y, but that doesn't mean if you manipulate X that Y is going to get stronger. So there's lots of complexity there. And I think from all the hundreds of studies that have been done on predictors of mathematics, I don't think there's one that stands out. But I would say that it is important to always think about the strongest predictors of math are going to be things that are directly related to math and not things that are really far away from math. you know, such as verbal working memory or visual spatial working memory. Sure, they're related, but probably the malleable factors are more things that have to do with learning how to produce multiple strategies, or early on linking symbols to quantities, building an understanding of ordinal sequences, being able to map numbers into space, being able to use number paths and then number lines. You know, those are, I think, early strong predictors that also have that malleability to them.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I think in my own understanding of sort of math and how it connects to what we're doing, it helps me kind of think about how I'm having these conversations with school teams and with parents as well, especially when there's a question about how can I support my child's learning. And actually, that's kind of a nice segue into our next question, because for a lot of students, math is really an especially anxiety-provoking experience, or it can be one. So we were wondering about any specific research or strategies that we adults, school staff, can take in supporting students' learning.
That's a great question, James. And the topic of math anxiety is such an important one, I think. You know, for many years, it wasn't really something that researchers were touching, but I think now there's a lot of research into math anxiety. I think the first thing about math anxiety is to be open about it and to talk about it in schools and schools communities. And I think at the level of educators, I think educators experience a lot of math anxiety themselves. I'm not saying all educators, but some do. And for those educators who experience math anxiety, that can have consequences for their students as well, because we've seen research that suggests that teacher and parents' math anxiety can rub off on students over time. So I think having that awareness, I think one thing that I would also suggest is doing a lot of math, like getting parents to do the math that the kids do in the classroom, having the teachers do math with each other during professional development to sort of also share that experience, you know, not make it this kind of scary thing that I put in one corner and I don't touch, but to actively confront it. And a lot of joy, I think, can be gained from that as well. I think in terms of concrete strategies, I don't think we have a really good research base on that yet. And many people are pursuing that. You know, a lot of the math anxiety studies are not longitudinal. They're not intervention studies. So we really need to get to that point. But what we do know is that things such as teachers' confidence in teaching math makes a huge difference to student math anxiety. So there are things I think we can do professionally to build people's confidence in math, not just the students, but also the teachers and the parents as well. So those are some strategies. But the other thing that I would say that's really important to know and acknowledge for everybody involved is whether it's teachers, parents, or the learners themselves, is that having math anxiety doesn't mean you can't do math. There's the link between math anxiety and math achievement is there, but it's very small. And you know, if you look at children who have severe math learning difficulties, many of them don't have math anxiety. So I think that's a hopeful message, because it suggests that math anxiety is something we can tackle separately from math learning and math ability. And it is something that can be overcome, and then those people can be excel in mathematics.
Thank you. Yes, I totally agree. And really good to hear that explicitly stated regarding sort of looking at those two, dealing with them somewhat separately.
So I appreciate the conversation around math anxiety, because I think being able to acknowledge first and foremost that adults may also have it is an important step in all of this. Also wondering about any specific strategies for building those math skills. So a while ago, you talked about just being able to creatively think, use multiple strategies. Is there something that we can do to build this ability, capacity in our students?
Yeah, that's a great question, James. I mean, I'm not an expert on pedagogy, so I wouldn't want to make very strong suggestions, but I think one of the things that we should be looking at is, you know, adopting principles from cognitive science into our teaching, such as, you know, spacing, making sure that you don't cram all the math into a short period, but that you distribute it over time, that you interleave problems, that you use different problem types in a lesson, Those are some basic principles from cognitive science that can be very easily applied. I think that, you know, it also depends on what level of education we're talking about. So if we're talking about kindergarten classrooms, in a playful way, orienting children's attention to number and numerical relations, and lots of teachers do that in very creative and beautiful ways. Those are some pieces that I would suggest, but I have to really be careful here, because as a researcher who is not an expert in math pedagogy per se, but more in how do children develop math skills, I want to be cautious in not overextending and making suggestions that are not backed up by data.
Of course. Much appreciated, Daniel.
Thank you. I'm wondering, we've spoken about many aspects of what you're involved in. Are there any other projects that you are currently exploring or are excited to talk about?
Yeah, we have a number of things that are quite exciting. One of them that I can share is that, you know, 10 years ago, we developed a screener called Numeracy Screener, and we put it on the web for free, and it's been used all over the world. So recently we decided, well, this is actually a few years ago, but we're now at a point where we're analyzing the data. We decided, why don't we reach out to people who had reached out to us about the screener and asked us about using it? And we ended up, you know, contacting people across, I think it's 16 different countries across 4 continents. And we've now sort of gathered all of our data together. So now we can sort of take a global look at early math learning using this tool. So I'm very excited about that. I'm very excited about us, you know, working more globally, going beyond just, you know, in research, we have a problem because we're being very biased towards the global north and majority countries. So reaching out, having more international collaborations and basically building international capacity around early numeracy is very important to me. And that's a project that I'm excited about. And related to that, we are working very hard on finalizing a digital version of our screener as well. So we hope to be rolling that out sometime towards the end of the year and working with school boards. And by the way, we're always looking for new collaborators, working with school boards on early screening, and hopefully, you know, because the paper and pencil tools are great, but as you know, scoring is always an issue. And if you can do that in the digital space, and if you can visualize students' performance in ways that are intuitive to educators, these are the kinds of things that we're excited about right now and working really hard to bring to fruition in the near future.
Thank you. I get excited just hearing about some of those different research issues that you're looking at, and particularly looking at it within different cultures. I find that fascinating. So thank you for sharing that.
Absolutely. Actually, my department and I, we were just talking about using different screeners with our kiddos. So this is a very timely nudge in that direction. Now, Daniel, just looking ahead to any other opportunities to access your resources, is there anything specific that you'd like to share as far as where our listeners can get more information, or maybe they can catch you on a speaking engagement?
Yeah. For sure. I mean, you mentioned my website, numericalcognition.org. There's lots on there in terms of research articles and little videos and so forth. I would also say numeracyscreener.org has some really good resources. You can link to that through my website. I would also recommend that listeners maybe take a look at there's a group called the Science of Math, which is kind of, you know, taking the leaf out of the Science of Reading sort of movement. It's very interesting, and there's some great advice. The other thing that I would, for those working with elementary students, is the Institute for Education Sciences in the United States, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with. They put out these wonderful practice guides, and they put one out for teaching elementary school students struggling with math. If you Google that in IES, you'll find it. It's an absolutely wonderful resource as well. So I would recommend looking at that. Those are some of the places I would recommend people to look. Maybe I'll mention one more, which is understood.org, which again, especially for parents listening, that can be useful if you, you know, whether it's math or any kind of exceptionality, there's lots of resources on there for caregivers, for parents, strategies, understanding what might be going on. So understood.org is a good resource as well, in my view.
Awesome. Thank you very much for sharing all that. And that marks the end of our episode. Thanks again for your time and expertise, Daniel. We really appreciate you.
Thank you.
To our listeners, stay tuned for our next episodes. Look to the show notes for all the resources that Daniel mentioned. You can find us on Apple, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Do rate and review us when you can. And in the meantime, we'd love if you connected with us on our socials at BCASP Certified on X, formerly known as Twitter, and Instagram, and BC Association of School Psychologists on Facebook. Thank you.